Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. So I guess the main news is that I'm actually back and recording a podcast again. I've been away for 5 weeks in Africa, maybe 6 or 7 weeks since I last recorded a podcast or last uploaded a podcast. I've got quite a backlog here. 5 weeks in Africa was awesome, real good trip. Me and Juliana, my girlfriend, went off and did that. We went to Kenya, Tanzania, Zanzibar, Malawi, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, and South Africa, all in 5 weeks. It was a pretty hectic trip, but really, really good fun. Now, if you want any news about that or anything else about that, you should go to my blog, lukeburridge.com/blog. There's nothing there about the trip yet, but there will be lots of photographs and videos and stories and everything going up there on my blog. So if you're interested in that, I'm actually got lots of stuff to share. I took loads of photographs. I'm a good photographer as well, so if you want to see some interesting photographs, check that out. And then when I got home last week, I've been super busy because I had about 5 weeks of other work and other stuff to catch up on. I had to get my shows in order, I had to get some other bits in order for my upcoming gigs as well. And also, my girlfriend, Juliana, is moving in with me, so I've had to rearrange everything in the house and do lots of bits and pieces like that. Yeah, it's been quite hectic, and because, I guess in another way, it's because I was like 6 weeks behind on this podcast, or 5 weeks behind on this podcast, or five episodes behind on the podcast, I've got lots of reviews to do. The more reviews that stack up, the less impetus I have to get to them, and but I do have a lot of time in the coming few weeks. I've got lots of gigs coming up. I'm doing 2 Atlantic crossings within 3 cruises. And as crossing the Atlantic on a cruise ship normally takes 6 days. So 6 days at sea without anything to do except hang out and read and write and do photos and podcasting and editing and things like that. I get lots of stuff done. So I listened to and read 6 books while I was away. The Citadel of the Autarch by Jean Wolfe. I'll get to that next. I read Bossy Pants, which is some memoirs, comedy memoirs by Tina Fey, which I'm not going to review on this podcast, but I've reviewed it on goodreads.com. I listened to the audiobook of Dune by Frank Herbert. I'll get to a review of that. The 100,000 Kingdoms, which is this episode. Zoo City by Lauren Bucus. And then Chasm City by Alistair Reynolds. So lots of things to get to. Now, even though The 100,000 Kingdoms was the third book, or the middle book of the 5 that I'm going to review out of that lot, because I actually made some notes on it as I was away, I thought I'd get to it here, because I did make some notes. Actually, I did make some notes on The Citadel of the Autarch as well, but they're on my iPhone and I forgot about them until I just mentioned them now. Dune, I don't need to make any notes on that because I've reviewed it before. I'll do another review, mainly of the audiobook version of it. Zoo City, I finished more recently, and so Chasm City also quite recently finished those two. And I know exactly what I'm going to say about that. So I thought I'd just get straight on to the more interesting review, which I have stronger opinions about than the other ones. Actually, no, I have very strong opinions about Zoo City and Chasm City and some about the Citadel of the Autarch. But I've got some negative feelings about this one. And when I'm writing down some notes about a review, those are the ones that kind of come to the surface. Now, I'm going to split this review into 2 halves, a bit like I did with Arctic Rising by Tobias S. Bakel, and split it into 1, it's the book and the content of the book. I mean, I say of the book, of the novel itself, and the other part is actually of the audiobook and the narrator. So I'll do the narrator first, because that's the first thing that hit me when I first read the book. But then I'll break off and do the normal review of the actual content of the novel. So The 100,000 Kingdoms, it's Inheritance Trilogy number 1. I didn't know it was a trilogy. Oh, no, I did know it was a... I knew that it had a sequel, because there's one that came out last year called The Broken Kingdoms, and it's by N.K. Jemisin. And paperback, it says here, 427 pages, published back in February of 2010. So it's like 2 years old, this book. The audiobook length is around about 12 hours long, which is a really nice length for me for an audiobook. So first of all, I just want to review the audiobook itself, or the reading. This book has the worst narrator ever. The worst audiobook narrator I've probably ever listened to, who's a professional. Like, there has been some books which I've stopped listening to because the narrator is bad. Actually, it was just bad. One was bad, which was the Doomsday book by Connie Willis. The narrator of that was a bit annoying, but I didn't stop listening to it because of the narrator. I stopped listening to it because I wanted to skip forward and skip around the book. If I was going to continue with it, I wanted to miss out parts of the book, and that's very difficult to do with an audiobook. But this narrator is called, from the 100,000 Kingdoms, is called Cassandra Freeman. And it's like every sentence that she's reading is though it's the first time she's read the sentence, and it's just her first go at it. And I think she is slightly dyslexic, that she can't see where commas are in the book. Now, it might just be like, maybe the punctuation isn't clear in the printed book, in the actual like paper book, the text of it. Maybe it's not very clear, but so many times she's making the same mistakes in the reading over and over and over again. And it's by putting pauses in the wrong place. Now, sometimes if you talk and you put some pauses in the wrong place, it doesn't matter too much, because when you do a pause, people can just sort of like mentally take out the pause and just sort of like carry on, and it doesn't affect the meaning so much of what you're saying. However, it gets really, really complicated to understand a book when at the end of a sentence, you're not quite sure if the sentence is finished yet or if there's going to be more. So what happens is that this is the kind of thing that I was having to put up with. So I wrote down as I was listening here, and I was talking to my girlfriend Juliana at the time. I was sort of like telling her about this, and she says, "Is it really this bad?" I was like, "Yeah, really, is this bad?" I'm just going to read out some examples here, and it's like I say, it's all about the pauses in the wrong place. And normally, if a sentence begins with a character like my mother, then what was it Cassandra Freeman, the narrator, puts a pause in after the first name, even if it's not that kind of sentence. Because normally you could say something like, "My mother my mother, murdered by jealousy, grasped my hand." And you're thinking, "My mother, murdered by jealousy." And you're like, okay, that kind of makes sense. But then grasp my hand. You're like, wait a second, the pause is in the wrong place. It should be, "My mother, murdered by jealousy, grasps my hand." You know, it's in a dream sequence. She meets a dead mother and stuff like that. And I'm just thinking, that was great. But "my mother, murdered by jealousy, grasps my hand." Really, really complicated. How about this one? It goes like this. "Tavril arrived early that morning to wake me for the occasion." It's like, no, you don't pause there. You go, "Tavril arrived early that morning to wake me for the occasion." There's not a pause after Tavril. "And he paused, frowning." And, you know, when you get a sentence like that, "and he paused, frowning," suddenly I'm not even quite sure of the meaning. Not only is it confusing, but it's like what's the meaning? Is it? Was he frowning? And then he paused, frowning? And then he continued on frowning again? Or did he pause, frowning? And it's really difficult to talk about this because I'm talking about the pauses in the sentence with the word pause in it. But it's like, how can this be too difficult to understand? You know, "he paused, frowning." That's what it should be, not "he paused, frowning." Pausing, frowning, and paused, frowning mean two different things, and I'm not quite sure what the writer means. And it's just really, and it like this way: "By the sounds of her footsteps, I realized she was pacing towards me and away." She realized she was pacing towards me and away. I think what was written on the page was something like, "By the sound of her footsteps, I realized she was pacing towards me and away." As in, I realized she was pacing, and then the "towards me and away" is describing the pacing, not that you realize she was pacing towards me. Again, little bit, like here, another example. "I saw that he was talking to someone else." Oh, no, sorry, my mistake here. "I saw that he was talking to someone else, perhaps, a servant." Okay, "I saw that he was talking to someone else, perhaps," means that he might have been talking to someone else, but "I saw that he was talking to someone else, perhaps a servant," means that someone else he was talking to was the servant. Now, I managed to work out the meaning of this because it was the only meaning that was there. But yeah, it was really difficult. I mean, I just wrote down these examples. All of these examples, or most of these examples, are from like one chapter. Half of them are from one chapter, these very short chapters in this book, and half of them are from another chapter. Constantly, as you're reading this book or listening to this book, this audiobook, I don't want to blame the novel for this, but constantly as I was reading it, it was just constantly distracting. Like, here's another example here. She is stunningly describing this angel or so, or this god. She is stunningly beautiful. Her hair is the color of bronze and a pair of wings feathered in gold. Silver and platinum are folded on her back. Okay, and I'm thinking, wait a second. Pair of wings feathered in gold and then silver and platinum are folded on her back. Is that like, does she have silver and platinum plates folded on her back, or what's going on here? And then I realized could have been a really good, like, written, this is a good sentence. Her hair is the color of bronze, and a pair of wings feathered in gold, silver, and platinum are folded on her back. And that makes a lot of sense, because you're bringing in the different colors of the, you know, gold and silver and platinum and blonde. You get the different colors, you get the different sort of striking imagery of an angel, like, which is the color of blonde and, you know, silver and gold and platinum and things like that. But yeah, like, it's difficult to understand when the pause is in the wrong place, and I have to actually pause the audiobook just to wait. Oh, go, wait a second, what's happening? So, in the same way with Arctic Rising, with all the bad grammar and spelling and sentence structure and passive voice and things like that, that all the time I was sort of like, one side of my brain was processing the bad writing and then passing it across to my other side of the brain, which could then enjoy the story. That's what I had listening to this audiobook all the time, just to get the meaning of the sentences and to get the meaning of what the author actually wanted to. Half of my brain had to be processing that at once, and then the other half of my brain could actually get on with enjoying the story or listening to the story and actually understanding what's going on. But that's not the only bad thing about this narration. That's the main part. The other big bad thing about, or and a few other bad things about it, is that the importantness or the import that is imparted into certain words and phrases and sentences and passages is the same. It kind of doesn't vary throughout. And when it does vary, something that's really, really important, like the destruction of an entire nation, is said with the same importantness as someone walking into a room and turning a light on, which is really weird and distracting, because I'm just like, why did you just say that in a really matter-of-fact voice? And then this other thing, which is obviously like a lot more important, just plan, you know, and yeah, I don't know, it's a bit strange. And finally, the thing that I really disliked was the choices of voices for the characters. Now, I don't mind that. Oh, let me put it this way. I start off with the child god. There's this child god who's meant to be around about 10 years old. But the voice that, let me just check her name of the narrator, Cassandra Freeman, chooses for Seiya, who is this little child god, who has never grown up, always taken the body of a child. It's not a child's voice of about 10 years old. It's this lisping toddler's voice that whines at every single sentence. And it's all like, I mean, I can't remember exactly what the voice was. Oh, no, I do remember what it was. Because it's in this southern kind of not South American, but like a southern United Statesian accent. And so a lisping toddler voice talking in an American accent. So like when he was saying stuff, it's like, hey, why did you have to do this, man? Why did you? But it's not even like that. It's like, this is what you have to do. And now Seiya is meant to be this young, lovable character. Every time Seiya spoke, it annoyed me. The voice grated on me because I don't expect young gods in a fantasy world to talk in an American accent with a lisping toddler voice when they're actually a thousands and thousands of year old god who just happens to be inhabiting a 10-year-old male body and with the attitudes and the outlook of and the optimism of a 10-year-old boy. And if it was just written on the page, I could have taken the words that Seiya was saying when he said, oh, you know, I don't think so. And what about this? And what about that? And what about this? You know, and he's actually saying this, these things, I can actually just put it into like a normal voice, into like a child's voice. You know, like I'm thinking back to like child actors in movies. Do you want someone who is like the kid in what is his name, Joel Harvey Oswald or whatever his name is, in The Sixth Sense? He's got this sort of like, he's a young boy, but he's got gone through obviously a bad experience, if you understand what I mean, and he's saying stuff, and everything he says you're like, oh wow, this actually means something to you, and you're saying it because you mean it, even though you're 10 years old. It actually means more because you're a 10-year-old thinking something through and saying it, and then I understand it, as opposed to Anakin Skywalker in episode 1, and you get this little kid going, whoa, now this is pod racing. There's a different kind of character there, and it means a lot when you get this lisping toddler voice, as opposed to just the voice of a 10-year-old boy who happens to be a god. And I'm not saying that every fantasy voice should be kind of old English, non-specific, you know, Eastern European kind of thing, but it really does help set the scene when it's not all, hey, gee, man, wow, what you going on, man? What's going on around here? And you might think I'm exaggerating the gee-haw, wow, man kind of voice. I'm really not. Maybe I'll actually find some examples in the audiobook and play them in. Maybe I'll see if I can work that out, how to do that in a second. If you don't hear it now, I haven't done it. Maybe I'll put it in there, though.
Does there have to be a reason for everything? Not as a man does with a woman. I just like you, Yaina. Well, there isn't. I told you, I do what I like, whatever feels good, as children do. There's no logic to it. Accept that or not, as you please. I have a feeling I'm about to have my own bargain thrown back in my face. I like you better than all the other Aramari. You're so much fun.
Also, you get the different things, which, like, when someone was saying something, it's like, hey, what do you think about this? And then, because everything was put into this American teenage voices in some points, you know, our main character is a young girl, like, teenage girl, I guess, what, 19 or 18 or whatever she's meant to be, maybe 20 or something like that. Like, she says things and goes up at the end. And so when she says something, it sounds like she's saying a question, even if she's not a question. But now I don't know if the author of the book, who is called N.K. Jemisin, I don't know if she wrote that as a question or not, but it's difficult for me to understand it just because of the voice. At one point is saying, and do you know who this was? And the main character goes, my mother? And I'm like, now, did it actually have a question mark at the end? Because if she did say, my mother, that makes a big difference. It's like, do you know who this was? My mother. It's like, my mother. She's come to realize that it was her mother. That's the first time we know that the character knows it was her mother. And it's like, my mother, as in, my mother did that. And I've suddenly come to notice it, but not like, my mother? My mother did that? Oh, I didn't know. And there's other bits and pieces where she just completely disregards the descriptions of the voice that she's going. So it's like, yes, spoken, what is it? Oh yeah, yeah. So someone says something, yes. And it says, and she says, yes, as in spoken low. And then it says, the voice male, but high-pitched and nasal. And I'm like, well, why didn't you do a high-pitched and nasal voice then? Another time when you're going like, when they're describing the voice of a god, it's sort of like, go-go-go-ra. He said in a low voice, but surprisingly human and not gruff. But she said it in, like, a low and gruff voice, so gruff that I didn't actually hear the words that the god had said. If it was not a gruff voice, I'd have been able to understand that line. But even when I rewound 30 seconds and listened to it again, the second time she said it, I didn't catch it because she said it in a voice too gruff, even though the description of the voice said not gruff. And also, one line that Saya says, this little child god says, he goes, this with a hint of petulance. And that line was said with a hint of petulance, except every single line that Saya says is said with not just a hint of petulance, but like a massive shovel full of petulant. Finally, the acting in the kind of offhand comments, because quite a bit of the story is told from a first person point of view, but written like as it is a kind of a memoir, but like as someone is talking to you. So it's very direct address. It's like, now let me think back. When did this happen? Oh, let me go back a bit and talk about this. Oh, yes, let me remember. I just remembered something else to tell you. I have to do this now. And those offhand direct address comments, which sort of tie bits of the story together, are actually some of the most scripted sounding parts. It's like, oh, now let me think. Should I tell you this or not? Or should I not tell you this? Okay, I think I'll tell you it later. Now, let me go back to the preview. You know, it's not like, should I? Okay, I'll tell you that. You know, there's none of the spontaneity which you need to impart into narration if something is written spontaneously. In other words, you can write something with spontaneity, but then when you read it, it sounds planned. But then other things that you can plan to write something so it seems spontaneous, and anyway, it's just completely messed up. So if I was going to be reviewing this as an audiobook, well, to be honest, let me explain. I started listening to this audiobook and I got maybe 20 minutes into it. And then it was so, the narration was so bad. And I was really interested, really intrigued about this, the book. I really wanted to read it. And I thought, well, I can't do it anymore. So I turned it off and then I had another go at it. And every single time, the confusing and annoying voices that the narrator was doing and the confusing talking and the speaking, all of that put me off again. So I stopped reading it and then listened to all of Dune by Frank Herbert. Read by a very good narrator, actually a cast of character, like voice actors and a narrator, and that was great. And then I came back and struggled through this book as well. Thank goodness for double speed playback, just so I could actually get through it and ignore the voice as much as possible. But it did really spoil this book for me, spoil my enjoyment of the book. But it's only a short book. I wasn't going to like get home and then buy it as an ebook or buy it as a paper book and read it again, because I already have it. I already spent an Audible credit on it. I just wanted to listen to it. So it was a real pity how bad this is. Now, let's get straight on to the review of the novel itself. The world is quite interesting in some points, which is good considering this book has very little plot. And because it's just one person finding out about how the world works, and the world is kind of interesting in a way, some parts of it. So you've got like this kind of Renaissance level secondary world, kind of fantasy world thing going on. And one of the main aspects of this is that gods are captives, because and so are the children. There's a single royal family which has control over the gods, and they can use the gods as tools, as weapons, as ways to keep order among all of the other nations in the world. And that's what the 100,000 kingdoms are. It's like the 100,000 kingdoms are ruled from the city of Sky. So the world is actually pretty peaceful, because anytime that two nations want to do trade or go to war, everything is centralized. Even if two countries want to go to war, they have to put in a notice and say, hey, we're going to go to war over here. And then it gets back to the capital city called Sky, and this one royal family which is controlling the gods, and they go, okay, yeah, you guys over there can do that. We'll work it out in this big kind of, there's a big, this big parliament kind of thing. Again, I'm thinking Coruscant in Star Wars, and you get that big parliament building, and there's some action happens in there, and there's senators and representatives and all these different kind of thing going in there. But there's this one powerful family that runs the place and runs Sky. And like I say, even though the world is pretty peaceful and everyone has it pretty good, you think, okay, something is rotten in the palace. Something is rotten in the halls of power. And you think, well, how rotten is it really in the city of Sky, which is run by this one thing? And of course, that is what the book is all about. So there's a city called Sky, and it's called Sky because it's up in the sky. And it's quite a fun invention. And again, coming back to my Star Wars comparisons, this is it Bespin, which is the cloud city of Bespin, where they go and meet Lando and stuff like that. So it's this city that's sticking on top of this really tall stick, and it's so high up that the only way it could be built was with the power of the gods, and the only way it runs is by the power of the gods, and the only way that the air is breathable up there because it's so high up is because the gods give it power, and the only way to get up there is because the gods have infused the walls, and you can travel up through the walls, and through the walls is like elevators and stuff like that. So it felt to me like a very kind of science fictiony kind of place, but run with these rules, which is actually just magic. In the same way that, you know, in Bespin, there's this big thing, this big shaft that goes down that Luke jumps down in the end and he comes down and there's a little thing that comes out the bottom and he hangs on there. That's kind of all in this book. And, you know, the sliding doors and the different areas and all in is it Bespin? Maybe I'm just coming up with random shit from the top of my head. The clouds, the mining operation. Yeah. Darth Vader turns up. Spoilers. Sky is quite, and again, and the other thing that I wanted to bring into this as well is that, like, in Star Wars, that all the different every different Star Wars movie has at least three different planets that they go to. They go to the Death Star, they go to the Hoth, they go to the Tatooine, and they go here and there and all around these different places. And it really feels, some of them feel really lived in, like Tatooine feels like it's all messy and Bespin feels much more clinical and the Death Star feels all grey or all white, you know, and then there's Jungle Planet. And here, Sky is very, very much like a very clinical kind of place, like with white walls and everything's set and everything works and there's elevators here and elevators there, everything is very set. So in a way, it's kind of an interesting thing, except the fact that once you actually get to it, you're like, ah, actually nothing here impacted the plot at all. There's this one device in the city, there's this one aspect of the city which needed to be there for the plot to work, but in the end you didn't really need to be in Bespin because there isn't any big fight in the ventilation shaft and Luke to fall down and lose his hand and to be rescued down at the bottom. So there wasn't anything like that. There's this one little thing and the rest of it could have actually just been set in any other city and the book wouldn't have suffered. Although one thing I did like about the city is that, you know, the fact that only relatives of the royal family could live and work in the city. And the reason, I mean, it was an interesting setup, and then I was like, oh, why is that? And then the reason for it was really good as well. I don't want to give it away here. But it is a pity that there wasn't actually a whole lot more in the city of Sky to get to. And then the name of the book is called The 100,000 Kingdoms, and I thought this was going to be a big setup to a sprawling political drama with lots of factions going up against each other, except that I think in total three countries or kingdoms are mentioned. Maybe four kingdoms are mentioned, but really they go from the, I think it's called Dara or something like that, where our main character comes from. She's not there at the beginning of the book. The book starts when she arrives in Sky. Then all of the action takes place in Sky or in the city next to Sky. I think there's another one at the base of Sky or the base of the palace or something like that. So, and then she takes one trip out to this other kingdom and then gets back again. So it's called the 100,000 Kingdoms, but it should really be called like the two kingdoms plus another one was mentioned, or the four kingdoms, you know, that's all we see. And I found that really disappointing. I thought we'd get a lot more of a tour around of the world. So the plot, as I was halfway through the book, I made a note and then I updated it at the other half of the book. So this is the plot. A princess spends half the novel finding stuff out. And then the second note was, and then the second half finding other stuff out, because that's really what we get. It's not quite true. She does have a bit of character development, tiny bit of character development herself. There is some story, there is something going on that she is affecting, but really all we're learning out is, all we're learning is backstory. The main character is called Yeni? I can't remember exactly the name, but anyway, her father was from the small kingdom and her mother was from the ruling family of Sky and all of the 100,000 kingdoms. And she was in line to the throne as well. And long, long before this book, the narrative of this book begins, the story that's set in this book begins, her father kind of came to the big city, wooed the mother, took her away, and the people back in Sky weren't that impressed. And then they lived out in Dara, which is the kind of Amazonian land for where women are in charge of everything. And of course, people back home weren't pleased about that. And then both of her parents have died, and Yini is called back to the capital city by her grandfather, who is the current king. She's told that she is now one of the named heirs to the throne, and now she's got like 10 days, or is it a week, or 2 weeks? I can't remember exactly the number of days, but she's got to work out how to not die when the heir who is going to ascend to the throne ascends to the throne. I know you may be thinking, well, shouldn't you really have more than one heir to the throne at once? And you're like, yeah, you do, kind of. But once you're on the throne, then you've got to name other heirs and you're going to be saying. So it was a really strange thing, you know, where it reminded very much of a kind of, hey, we're in Rome and I'm the emperor and I'm going to adopt this person as my son and they're going to become the emperor after me. That kind of thing going on. And I was just thinking, well, what's she going to do for this time? And she, of course, she's got to work out how not to die, but that doesn't, she doesn't really have any power over that because gods exist and they have control over the gods. So you're thinking, well, that, you know, what can they do, which isn't just saying to the gods, hey, make it so I don't die, or hey, make it so this happens and this happens. So the first bit of trouble that she gets into with a god, oh, the god is there, you know, she just goes, oh, god, don't let me be harmed. And suddenly she's not harmed anymore. Or in another situation, she just goes, oh, hey, god, can you do this for me? Excuse me, god, over there, Naru, whatever your name is, can you make sure this doesn't work? And then they just do it for her. So you're thinking, okay, so that's, the drama isn't going to be like, is she going to be killed or not? And then you're like, well, why is she going to be killed when she gets to the throne? But anyway, it comes down to the point is that she's got 5 days or a week or something like that. She knows she's going to die in 5 days. So what does she do? She tries to, you know, find out about her mother and her history and the history of the gods and stuff like that. Thing is, when you're friends with like 3 gods, as well as like important people in the kingdom and court functionaries and things like that, and they have pity on you because you're the new girl coming in, you're young, you're the country barbarian in the new court. It's like, how difficult can it be to find stuff out if you're friends with 3 gods? You actually can tell a god, because they have to obey you, can actually tell them, hey, give me the answers to this. But somehow the working out what's going on takes up a lot of the book. So here's some other problems with the plot. Another few problems with the plot after that is that there was another book that I read, which is set in a weird city called The City in the City by China Mieville. And in there, one of my main complaints about that was that the main guy, the protagonist, spends a lot of time walking around the city or biking around the city or whatever he was doing, trying to find out the story of somebody else who'd spent time in that same city. And the story of him finding out about that story wasn't as interesting as the story that he found out about to me. And it's the same in this situation as well. Like, we have a story of Yeni. Oh, excuse me. So here we have the story of Yeni, and we have the story of her finding out about the story of her parents and their interactions with the royal family and the gods. And I thought the whole story of her parents, all the backstory, was actually way more interesting than her story, because her mother had a problem and she solved it in this different way. Her father wanted to do this and he solved it in this way. And you find out about all these problems that they had in their lives, which they had to solve without the power of being able to just say, hey, God, you God over there, come here, do this. Thank you. Got me sorted. Thank you very much. And that kind of story is, for me, way more interesting. In the same way that in The City in the City, we have a guy who's a policeman who has access to different places and he can cross the border, he can do all of this kind of stuff, finding out about how someone who was had a lower status than him got by in the same situation. I was like, no, let me, why can't we have that story? It really did feel like, in some ways, that I was reading the second book in a series and it was about someone who was working out what happened in the first book. Because actually, at some points in this book, I was thinking, wait a second, is this the second book in the trilogy or is this the first book? Am I finding out about what happened to the daughter of the main characters in the first book? I wanted to read the prequel of this, except now I already know the story. But I would have rather read the prequel to this book than this book itself. And then about halfway through, I was wondering, hey, what else does Yini need to know? You know, before she actually does something to get herself out of the problem. And it turns out, like I mentioned before, the whole book is about her finding out about her own backstory. And then once she's found out enough about that, she finds out about other aspects of the world and of, you know, the religion and the history of the gods. And so the second half of the book is mostly about her kind of like hanging around and having sex with gods and stuff like that. And I really enjoyed the sex scenes. Well, in some ways, I thought the sex scenes were interesting. I don't want to give away what elements I found interesting of the sex scenes. Some of them was a bit like, woo, sex with a god, how awesome is this kind of thing. And there are other bits which are a bit like slightly more subtle than, woo, we're going to fly around the world while having sex. We're going to dive into the center of the sun while having sex, you know. But like, if all you're doing is counting down the days until you die, and all you're going to fill it with hot sex with a god, it's like, again, how does that make an exciting story? How can I root for the character when gods are rooting for her and rooting her at the same time? It's like, you know, especially when you've already guessed the ending, which is, of course, spoiler. She's nah. I won't spoil it. Obvious ending coming up here as well. So you think like, okay, so all of this story, it's like, why does this person have no curiosity? This is my main complaint about stories like this, is like, she is 20 years old, whatever she is, late teenager and stuff like that. She is a princess. She is the granddaughter of the king of the entire world. She is cast out of that society, but now she lives in a different society down here in this different, like, you know, country bumpkin kind of little kingdom over here, which is all run by women and stuff. But she's important there. She's running the army or something like that. And she's in line to rule that country before she gets taken over here to this country. Now, so I'm not just saying, okay, as a status thing, where's the jeopardy coming from and all that kind of stuff if she's that powerful already. But if you are the granddaughter of the king of the world, you'd think you'd go, I wonder how the world works and why I'm the granddaughter of the king of the world. Why am I not living over there? Why am I over here? Why aren't I over there? And if I was to go over there, now that I know I have to go over there, why don't I find out all the things that I need to know about over there before I go over there? So that means when I get over there, I'm in a bit of a better situation. But there's nothing like that. It's like she arrives outside the gates of Sky, literally with no knowledge of her own history, no knowledge of her father, no knowledge of her mother, no knowledge of her grandfather, no knowledge of her cousins, which could be really interesting. I mean, knowing about her cousins could have been really handy. She doesn't know about the not just the main religion, but the only religion in the world that she has to know about, because if you don't know about this religion, or if you think, if you subscribe to a different religion, not only is that sort of heretical, but also it's wrong because gods actually exist. So the religion is almost like a history. Religion is history. Magic is science. How can you not know all of this stuff? So she arrives as a complete blank slate, and then she, like, is it totally ignorant about the politics, about everything, and then she starts learning out about stuff as the book begins. And I'm like, why do you only care about knowledge? Why do you only care about the world? Why do you only get curiosity now at this stage of your life when you know you're gonna die in 4 days' time and you need to get yourself out of the situation? What kind of life have you lived up until this point when the only impetus you have to learn anything at all about the world is your own imminent destruction? And I found that really difficult. And this isn't the only book that does this. I've read other novels about exactly the same kind of thing. It's sort of like, well, now let's go out into the world and find stuff out, because there's a problem over here. And that's just totally the opposite to me. And I really enjoy reading novels about people who have a reason not to know something up until that point, and then suddenly have a reason to know it and then find out about it. You know, if we're talking about fantasy, how about the Chronicles of Narnia? Hey, check it out, guys. We're going to go through here. You cannot know anything about the world, so when you turn up, you are ignorant. You are that blank slate, and you can find out about it and then use that knowledge to gain more stuff. Or maybe in Tolkien or something like that, where you get these hobbits living over here where they've got a very sheltered life. Hey, we don't know anything about this, but we're thrust out into the world. You better know about this stuff, because if you don't know about this stuff, fucking bad things are going to happen and you got to do this. You know, people in the novel know about stuff and then they tell you when you ask and they tell you when you need to know it. And you tell, I mean, you as the reader, but, you know, vicariously through the character. And here we get someone who is just totally, totally ignorant because she is ignorant, because she has no curiosity finding out about stuff for pretty much the entire novel. So, yeah. And at the end, she becomes a god. And you're thinking, well, if she was going to do that anyway, why did she need to know about all this stuff that she learned about? Because when you become a god, you just know it all anyway. So why did we have to go through all of this kind of stuff if she was just going to get to that point anyway at the end and then know all of that stuff because now she's a god or co-spirit with a god? Massive spoiler for the end now, but if you didn't see it coming, like around about page 50 of this book, I don't know what's wrong with you. But again, it does impact it. It's like, well, if at the end of the book, you're just going to become a god and solve everyone's problems, why did you have to go all through that thing? Now, it's not like a Peter Hamilton book where at the end someone becomes a god and sorts everything out. It's because normally, when someone becomes a god at the end and sorts everything out, they have to go through all the steps to get there, to know that, that, you know, to actually become the god at the end, they've got to go through all these steps, and then the god is like the payoff. Whereas here, if she hadn't done anything, she'd have probably been all right. I mean, as far as my understanding is it, I mean, maybe I'll sort of start getting a bit distracted at the end of the novel. Anyway, not got much else to say about this novel. I've sort of wrapped up most of the things about it. The bad guys, talking about the characters here, not really bad. There's like, they have to be bad and they have to do some bad things. And I thought it would be much more interesting if the people who had to do bad things did them because they had to do them rather than because they were bad people and liked doing them. Again, much more interesting. All of that kind of dynamic was totally left out. I mentioned before about the characters. Like, why do I care about these gods? They're not even human. They're more like logical alien robots of tremendous power. And it's like, well, they say, you even say, oh, these gods are not human. Don't try to identify them on a human level because you won't be able to. They're existing separately from us. And I was like, well, that's an interesting idea. But then when it's sort of like, oh, this god has lost power and they're still the most powerful thing in the world, but they're not quite as powerful as they used to be. And then pissed off about that. And then at the end of the book, they become the most powerful thing in the world again. At the end, you're like, well, you know, dropping down from the most powerful thing in the universe down to the most powerful thing in the only world which matters, and then to go back up to the level of most powerful thing in the universe again, that's not kind of the character arc that I find that interesting. So don't really care about that. So a princess heir to a throne in one country is suddenly told she's going to become the princess heir to the throne of the entire world, and then she lives in luxury with thousands of servants and then has sex with gods and all that kind of stuff. I tried really hard to care about her, but couldn't. But then some of the minor characters, I was actually quite interested in them, you know, sort of like they had to put up with the gods and they had to work with the heirs to the throne and they had to work with the royal family and clean up after them and sort out their problems and like lay down their lives for them at some point. At least there's a threat that they've got to have to lay down their lives for them. And I'm thinking, well, why can't I read the story of, was it Tavril, the young guy or the guide of the palace or something like that? He would have been cool. Or the story about the magician guy, you know, the magician writer guy. It was a long time ago that I listened to this, so I can't remember all of the names of these places. The magic in the book is okay, I guess. It's a bit weird because it's all based around, okay, there's a stone which controls the gods, and if you have a sigil, can't remember the word, a mark on your forehead, if you've got this little mark on your forehead, then you can control this, and the higher you're up, the closer you are to the trunk of this family tree, the closer you are to the main line of this family tree, the more control over the gods that you have, and the further away that you are, like if you're 20th in line to the throne, you don't have as much power as the person on the throne or the person next to the person on the throne. And if you're 4,000th in line to the throne, you still have a little bit of power, but less, you know, and the whole of this kingdom with the ruling family, everyone has some access to the magic, but of course, diminishing access to the gods and things like that. And the gods are very loyally, they're like lawyers, can't even say the word. They have rules. They're very logical. So if you say, kill everyone, but don't kill me, but kill everyone, they will just kill everyone. They don't care if they're always looking for excuses to do stupid shit. They're all chaotic, but logical chaotic. It's a weird thing. It's that up until the bounds of the rules that you set for them, they will do everything and anything that they can to screw you over and stuff like that. So there are some quite interesting stories of people kind of going, oops, sorry, I didn't mean kill. Oh, shit, you killed my wife. And I just meant, all I did was ask you to shut her up and you killed it, you know, that kind of thing. So everyone has to have these little protection wards against the gods so they can't be harmed by the god. Or the gods that they're dealing with at the time, but they have to be really careful that the gods don't screw them up in another way. And I thought this could be a really interesting thing. And in the same way, what was it, Spellwright, or whatever that novel was, by another fantasy book, which is not this kind of thing, but it's sort of like, oh, I thought this would go into lots of different cool magic stuff where, you know, like a Brandon Sanderson novel where it's like, oh, I've written out the rules for this, you know, this magic so well that when you read them, you'll be able to find out all these different possibilities for the magic. And then later on, I'll do something not quite like that, but something even cooler, which is also just as logical and you'll be able to work it out. And I thought we were going to get stuff like that happening in this book, but then it's a bit clumsy at some points. First of all, that kind of happens in some ways, but it's not that interesting. Most of the things, like most of it's reported, like, oh, this person did this and did something bad, and this person did this and the god did something bad, but that's nothing really happens to our main characters in the way. But then, like I say, some sloppy writing, like at one point our main character goes, God damn you. And she actually says that to some gods. And I was like, is that... So if you say to gods, God damn you, what would happen in that situation? And for her, it's just like, you know, the way that the narrator said it. Hey, God damn you! Yeah, and I was thinking, wow, that what effect would saying God damn you to a god have? And it's just skipped over and nothing mentioned at all. I was like, oh man, my brain has taken this in ways that other things aren't happening. Oh yeah, and then halfway through the book, she needs to go home. So you go, oh, don't worry, I can teleport you there. And the god just takes her off and teleports her around the world. And I was like, what, fuck? Wait a second, so now, halfway through the book, you're telling me that you can teleport me somewhere outside of the castle? Well, tell you what, if my life is in danger, how about you teleport me away and don't take me home again? Or how about, like, I've only got 4 nights to live, so instead of us just hanging around in the palace all this time and sleeping and stuff, tell you what, why don't we just travel around the world for days and days at a time? And tell you what, wait a second, if you're a night god, why don't you continually travel around the world? If you can teleport, trivially, why don't you just continuously travel around the world so every 24 hours you spend at night? So you're the most powerful god in the world because you're the night god. Why don't you just keep going in night? You know, and these other questions that come up with this little bit sloppy magic stuff, but a lot of the magic stuff is overly confusing. You're never quite sure why a god is called this and then sometimes called that, and then you find out about it and you're like, well, okay, well, that's yeah, you could have mentioned this earlier. And if you were going to mention it earlier, why do rules only come into effect in the world once the author decides to mention them and once the reader finds out about them? Again, slightly disappointing. Yeah, moving on. Writing. I only made one note about writing, or the writing of the book, as I was reading it, because I tried to kind of put that over my brain because I didn't read it. I was listening to this audiobook, which was messing my brain up most of the time. But at one point she said, oh, I need to go to the ladies' room. Now, if there's something which takes me out of the novel, like out that I'm not in this secondary world fantasy novel more than a fantasy novel read in sort of like American accents, like I'm watching an episode of Sesame Street or something like that, is when a character says that they're going to the ladies' room. I'm just like, really? In Bespin, there might have been ladies' rooms and men's rooms, but we never saw anyone in Star Trek going to the toilet. But if you tell me that there's ladies' rooms and men's rooms in a, like, Renaissance-style palace in the sky in a fantasy world, again, it kind of just goes, have you even thought about what you're saying here? So, bring on, finally, very short bit here at the end of it, the themes of the book. I thought it was going to be political intrigue. It turned out to be kind of like fantasy romance. And you're like, all these kingdoms, no way to tell them apart. There's senators coming in and out and doing this kind of stuff. And just nothing there at all on a political level at all. I mean, because in the end, that's not what the book is about. And for a book called 100,000 Kingdoms, kind of disappointing. So as I was getting ready, I was like 10 minutes before I started recording this, Tamahome, who you may know that name from the SFF audio podcast, he sent me a message on Skype. And let me just bring it up here. It said, we missed your podcast, Luke Burridge. I said, I'm just about to record one. I said, and then I said, have you read 100,000 Kingdoms? He said, is it feminist fantasy? And that made me think, feminist fantasy. Well, I guess it could be. Some people might term this as feminist fantasy, but like for me, it's not feminist fantasy, it's just feminine fantasy. And that's what I wrote back to him, because I didn't even think about mentioning this, because I didn't even think that this book could even be slightly considered a feminist work. Again, I'm saying this as a male guy, but you know, I like to think I'm kind of a feminist in some ways. I know it's a bit, again, strange way to put it, but I do enjoy reading about characters who, or stories which are about females, but more than that. And if it's just going to be a female character in a role, great, they can be female and they can do whatever they want. But if you're going to say it's a feminist work, it has to actually be about, for me, to be called classed a feminist work, about the issues of feminists or feminism and about women's equality with men, or their struggle for equality with men, or how better they are than men. You know, there's lots of different novels that I've read. For example, Arctic Rising was about a female character and a lesbian, and it was really refreshing to read a strong character who was just getting on with stuff, and that she was a female, and that she was a lesbian, and that she was black, and that she was from Africa, was just included in the story and made part of it, and it actually became just a strong character, just an interesting character to spend time with. And And that's what I want. Or someone, you know, you got all these bloggers railing against R. Scott Bakker about his books and that they're all about rapey, rape, rape, rape. But I actually think these middle two books of this series that he's doing now very much about feminist issues and things like that, and about women trying to become equal with men in a fantasy world was here. I actually just mentioned this to Tam at Homie. I just said, shit, I wasn't even going to mention that in my review, but I guess it's a good point to bring it up, because you do get the place where she is from, the place where what's her name again, our main character, Yeni, she is from this kind of Amazonian country called Dara, and Dara is, you know, women warriors, they do all the fighting, they run the place, everything is women doing everything about it. And I thought, oh, this could be interesting. She even goes on a trip there, she goes on a magical journey with her night god over there, and they meet up with this thing, and I'm thinking, well, how is this going to help her get by in a more kind of patriarchal society back in Sky? But even the fact that she can take over and she can become the leader means that it's actually, that's more of an equal kind of place. So I would think that, like, that the Amazonian kind of women running everything is not kind of a feminist ideal. I would say that's not even, I wouldn't even say it's an ideal. It just seems to be weird that that's posited as a good thing in a good culture where men are put down by women and people aren't equal. And I was like, well, what's the difference between that and a men's? And then I was thinking, okay, if you're going to be brought up in an all-female court and an all-female environment, how is that going to help you out when you get to the big city? And it turns out, not at all. Hardly mentioned, no effect at all. I was surprised when it came up around about a quarter of the way through the book that she was brought up in this matriarchal Amazonian kingdom that the other countries or the other kingdoms sneered at because it was all run by women and they didn't think women were good enough. Like, if that only comes up a quarter of the way into the novel and then is meant to be a massive part of someone's upbringing and then is, like, hardly affecting the book at all, to a point that it didn't even matter that she came from somewhere like that, how is that helpful at all as a feminist novel or text or fantasy or anything like that? And then, if you are going to do it as a feminist, like, how is she going to get her way with the gods? How about having sex with the gods? Because there's quite a lot of that in this book. And I think, well, I guess that will work out, you know. I wouldn't mind having sex with a god, especially if I get my way and they don't kill me at the end and stuff like that. Yeah, that's okay. And then, oh, about this other god. This other god's helping me out, but I never had sex with that. Ah, but actually, I was a substitute mother figure for that 10-year-old god, and that's why he loved me. It was actually nothing to do with me as a person. I could have been anyone, but because I had the, you know, I became the substitute mother figure god, or maybe not even substitute, spoilers, all that kind of stuff going on, you think, well, that's strange. So how about using, like, universal human traits like intelligence and skills to get you past things? No, I'll just have sex with the god. Have sex with the god, that's the easy way to get through. So the last thing I want to mention really is the final bit. The main thing that I actually really enjoyed about the book, except for finding out about the story of Yini's mother and father and all that kind of stuff, is, and I thought actually the history with the gods, the mythology, the theology, the fantasy religion that we have here is very well explained in this book, is really, when it comes down to it, a religious text for a fantasy religion which doesn't exist. And when I worked out that's what I was getting, I actually really enjoyed it in some ways, up to a point. And again, everything that I enjoyed about this book was always up to a point and in some ways. There's a created religion. I can't remember what the religion is called. I can't remember what any of the gods were like, but I do remember lots of parts of it, and I enjoy, like, how it was explained, and there was these gods, and there was this, you know, there was gods, and they fought each other, and there was three of them, and then one of them died, or one of them was cast out, and then the other ones and their kids were subsumed, and then this other one came up to the front, and it didn't really feel like a fantasy kind of religion, because it actually felt too much like real mythology. It actually felt too real to this world. And, you know, and then you had, like, these magic amulets and languages and ways to communicate and these different ceremonies, and to keep the gods in check, you had to do this and you have to do that and you have to do layers and layers of really cool stuff, all things I actually find quite cool. In some ways, it also reminded me of Lord of Light, because you're getting these gods wandering around a city, you're actually going in, and in a good way, it reminded me of that. But the thing that I didn't like about it was that the book revolves around Yini finding this stuff out. And again, I'm just thinking, well, first of all, why isn't it already known? And I was thinking maybe this is because she didn't already know it just because she's ignorant about it. But then I was thinking, well, how can that be if this religion is true? And if this religion is true, why doesn't everyone know about it? And then you actually find out actually the religion isn't true. I mean, the gods actually exist, but it turns out the things that some of the gods are saying that isn't factually correct and that they've worked some stuff out. But if the gods that you're actually learning about are standing in front of you, like the god is right there, like you go, ah, I wonder what the full story is behind this god who is standing right next to me, who I'm having a conversation with right now. You're thinking, well, why don't you just say, hey, tell me what's up? And there's these little things that are put in sense, like, ah, oh, because no, I want to respect the gods and I want you guys to respect and like me, so I'm never going to command you to tell me something, except when she actually does want to command someone to tell her something. Then to get out of her plot hole, she does command them to tell her something. But no, I don't want to command it, it's like that. So why doesn't she get the full story? But then you're like, well, why doesn't she already know it already? And everything's really dragged out. It takes us so long to find some stuff out. Now, there are some really interesting meanings to religion and real religions. I say real religions, not true religions, but real religions in the real world, in our world. Things like Scientology is a mystery religion. Same with Mormonism, they're mystery religions. If you're not inside Scientology, you're not allowed to know the true mysteries at the top. And Scientology goes a long way to stop people finding out about that kind of stuff. Mormonism is, you know, has secrets as well, that as you get further into it, you learn more and more and more about it. As opposed to, say, the Jehovah's Witnesses, which is another more recent religion, another offshoot of Christianity, which isn't about that. It's because Jehovah's Witnesses came up with someone looking through the Bible and was going, hey, wait a second, the Catholics and the Protestants, they've got it all wrong. Actually, what it all means is this. And Jehovah's Witnesses want you to know all the answers up front. That's what they want to do. It's like, hey, you got any questions? Tell us about it. There's all this information. Read all this information. Know everything. And then you'll like the religion so much that you want to come in. Whereas a mystery religion like Scientology is like, hey, you know, we can help you out a bit here. And you go, oh, really? How? Oh, well, just come and do this personality test. And you're like, oh, good. And you do that, and then the next step, and then the next step, and then the next step, and the further in you get, the more powers you get. Scientologists believe that, you know, you can see through walls and heal yourself and, you know, regrow your hair. And there's loads of superpowers that Scientologists have. You know, all the stuff about Xenu and all that kind of stuff is just the mysteries that go around with it. But as you get further in, you get more power, and you get further up, not just power over, you know, miracle kind of powers, but also more power within the church as well as you go through. Now, this is, you know, called Gnosticism, or in some situations this can be called Gnosticism. And it's, you know, it's to be, okay, it's a secret. Only the religion is revealed, the true religion is revealed to a very, very few people, a select few. And if you come into this and do this initiation, if you get baptized, we will then tell you about the next level and you can level up, and then you have another ritual and we'll tell you another, or you get pay some more money and then you can come in and find out a bit more. And then you can find out a bit more. It's like the Matrix. It's like, hey, do you want to take the red pill or the blue pill? If you take the blue pill, you don't come any further. If you take the red pill, you're in. And then you do. And then once you're in there, it's like, oh, do you want to know a bit more or do you want to know a bit less? And then you keep going in and layers. And as you get more layers into it, like the Matrix, as Neo found out more and more and he gained more and more skills, he gained more and more powers. This makes for a really interesting journey into a religion as you find out more and more and more about it. However, in the 100,000 kingdoms, there was no reason for any secrecy like that. There was this one thing which was kind of secret. Maybe it was secret within the family or within Sky, within the city itself. But everybody in Sky knew about it. If you're born into the family, you'd know about it. Everything was there. Everything should have been out in the open. Everything could have been out in the open. There would have been no problems to the religion, even to the gods themselves, if everybody knew the truth of their religion. Because, wait for it, the religion was actually true. Everything was there. It's not like Scientology, whereas when you get further and further into it, it gets more and more batshit crazy. But as you get further into it, you get more money and you've paid more money and then you're sort of committed into it and things like that. And it's not like, you know, Mormonism, where the extra powers come in the next life. And if you live your next life as a Mormon, you keep going and keep going, you actually become a god at the end of Mormonism. You actually have your entire universe and you have all your wives there and everything's there. Everything's with you. But then all the results are in the next life. In this book, in 100,000 Kingdoms, the results are right there. The knowledge could be right there, but it was all kept secret for seemingly no reason. And I really like secret religions. I really like delving into religions and myths. And as you find your way back further, you know, when you read into the Bible and you go back further, you find the myths that underlie the myths in the Bible. And then there's another layer under there, and there's another layer under there, and you find out the meanings behind all that kind of stuff. That's really interesting. But there must be a reason why the most basic part of it is secret. And if it's not, well, it's unsatisfying. So this, as a conclusion, this review has been mostly negative, but I did enjoy, I mean, I did get to the end of this book, so I might as well give it, I was going to give it 2.5 stars, but I realized actually 2 stars is what it would, if it wasn't for the bad narration, I would give it 2.5 stars, but the bad narration really brought it down. I could never really get that out, so I'm going to give it 2 stars at the end of this. So thanks for that. This has been quite a long review. Sorry about that, but it's the first one in 6 weeks, so hopefully you don't mind me going a bit longer than I originally planned. You can email me, luke@juggler.net. You can also keep in touch with me in the books that I'm reading and send me messages and even chat with other SFBRP listeners. There's a discussion forum right there on goodreads.com. Search for SFBRP listener group, or search for my name, Luke Burridge. You'll be able to follow me, get in contact with other listeners and stuff like that. That's the best way to do it. Otherwise, check out my blog, lukeburridge.com/blog. I'll be putting up lots of videos and photos and stories and stuff from my Africa trip, and lots of other stuff goes up there as well. I did actually try and do a daily blog post for a while. Now that I'm back from Africa, I'm going to start that up again, now that I'm going to get a bit more time, and I'll have some more time on these upcoming work trips as well. That's it for now. Thanks a lot, and I'll catch you next time.